From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Bill Clinton, right? He couldn't say, hey, I never had sex outside my marriage in my life.
When someone's in true addiction, they would prefer the substance than drawing oxygen.
What you're saying then convinces me that you would see that it's important that a minister is mentioned in departmental tweets then.
No, I see.
Going back around to the start.
Nicely done.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, dare we dream the dream of a city break this summer? When is a chimney iconic and when is it not? And not all lies are bad. That's all on the way over the next hour of the entire world's biggest and best radio catch-up service ever. Let's start Tuesday's Playback Daily with our usual visit to what I'm still insisting on calling the newsings that make up most of the first half of the Ryan Tuberty Show. This morning, Ryan was casting an envious glance across the water.
This is interesting watching the British getting back into the world of kind of nearly post-lockdown. There's a sense of freedom in the air over there watching the British news by and large. But one thing I've noticed is the team that's running, and I'm counting myself first and foremost among the types of people who do this, by the way, is basing freedom on booze. Have you noticed that? That nearly every piece in the news was, we're free, and raise a glass for it. We're free, the pub's open. One of them I saw was a countdown to midnight, to when they, because that's when the virus stops, at midnight. And it was 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, clunk, straight in, beer garden, everyone at 1 minute past 12. No doubt to the delight of the neighbours of the estate the pub seemed to be in. Good luck with that. And then yesterday, you could see crowds gathering. There was at one stage in Camden or somewhere in London, there was a spontaneous outburst of cheering. This is a post-World War II, but all based on booze. And when, it's funny, we've been saying it ourselves, of course we're all dying to go away and so ever, but the first thing we're going to do is raise a glass as soon as humanly possible, a decent, there's only so many beers one can have without, especially if you like a Guinness, you know, you want a decent one, the cans, and yeah, forget about it. So it is intriguing how the happiness appears to be dictated by its correlation to booze. We're as bad, they're as bad. Although I do see a tweet by a guy called Fergal who says, sure, they get to go to the pubs, but they're English pubs. So just how fortunate are they really? Chain owned, fruit machine filled hell holes where they grab the pint out of your hand mere minutes after closing time. Literally not even as good as Zoom cans. I think that's true. I think they are the worst pubs. They're very pretty, some of them, especially if you go into the country, no doubt about it. But you wouldn't want to be going in there on the tear with your pals because, as Fergal rightly says, as soon as the barman sniffs the hour towards closing time, you can feel a tension in the air, and then they're grabbing the pints out of your hand. But anyway, they certainly have that level of freedom there, so off they go.
And good luck to them, right? We'll get there sooner or later. Later, probably, because, you know, it's us. And Dublin's iconic pool-beg chimneys are us as well, and that's probably why we don't want to take any responsibility whatsoever for them.
The ESB, says the journal.ie, has warned the foundations of Dublin's iconic pool-beg chimneys, you know, the red and white ones, they're at risk due to the presence of sulphur at the base of the towers as councillors continue calls for the stacks to be restored and repainted. Certainly, there's not much point if they're going to fall down off their own accord. The ESB said chemical analysis undertaken last year identified the presence of the corrosive element, which could affect the durability of the chimney's foundations. When I go on a walk, I see them pretty much all the time across the bay. And I like them. I would feel it would be strange if they weren't there. I think they're part of the landscape. And I think also when you're flying into Dublin from, you kind of go, oh, it's like a beacon, home, you know. I'd be sorry to see them go, to be honest with you. So hopefully they can fix it up. They were built in the 70s and used as part of the ESB's gas turbine, which provided electricity for 500,000 homes in Ireland. But they were given a lifespan, operationally at least, of 25 years. And here we are from many years later, and it looks like they're kind of in jeopardy. But this comes up every so often. Here it is again. Hopefully somebody somewhere decides, no, let's just agree we're going to commit to these chimneys.
From one iconic pair to another. Tenuous link alert.
And Macaulay Culkin, meanwhile, and his girlfriend Brenda Song, they had a baby. How about that? Their son is called Dakota, and he's a double barrel name, so it's going to be Dakota Song Culkin. and they had the baby. And his brother, Kieran Culkin, who plays Roman Roy in Succession, also welcomed a baby with his wife, Jazz Charton. They've got great names, aren't they? In September 2019. So the Culkins are all babied up. Prior to his romance with Song, Culkin dated Mila Kunis. What? For 8 years? Good Lord, would never say what time together, but there you are. And then he ended up with Miss Song and now add baby two. Staying with movies, Carrie Ann Moss, who you know from The Matrix, said that the day after her 40th birthday, she's literally the day after, not literally the day after, and then not meaning literally, the day after her 40th birthday, she said, I was reading a script that had come to me and I was talking to my manager about it. And the manager was saying, no, don't. Why are you reading? Not that role. You're meant to be reading the grandmother's role. The day after. She was obviously talking about, you know, ageism in Hollywood. And she said, I may be exaggerating a bit, but it happened overnight. I went from being a girl to the mother to beyond the mother. And went on to note that she doesn't feel men in her industry face the same level of scrutiny, adding, you don't feel like you've aged much. And suddenly you're seeing yourself on screen. And I would look at these French and European actresses and they just had something about them. They felt so confident in their own skin. I suppose a different breed and different sense of confidence, no doubt about that. And she will be playing Trinity in a fourth Matrix film later this year. Kind of lost the Matrix thing after the first one, but I think it's extremely popular and people love a bit of Matrix in their lives. So that's no doubt a very exciting development for the Matrix heads among you this morning.
How are the Matrix heads today? Hope you're feeling better. Maybe a coloredy shirt would make a nice change from that black latex.
The Hawaiian shirt. I'd be 7 minds about the Hawaiian. Obviously, I've never owned one. Obviously, I've never wear one. Might try it this week, maybe Friday night, just for a change. No, never going to happen. But the return of the Hawaiian shirt has been celebrated in the style press. Bill Murray wore one recently at the Golden Globes. Rihanna's wearing, Sophie Turner's wearing one. But enter stage right, the Davis Center for Historical Studies at Princeton University. Glasses up on top of nose, stroke chin, point head, and let's see what they have to say. They say, according to Zara Anish Anslin, that the Hawaiian shirts are the fashion equivalent of a plantation wedding. Now, that's a loaded thing to say. They could be seen as fashionable embodiments of the history of American colonization, imperialism and racism against Hawaii's indigenous inhabitants, and people might want to think twice about whether the look is worth the weight of its associative past. Wow. You know the expression, who knew? I did not know. Answering what was initially a rhetorical question, but it isn't anymore. Hawaiian shirts have been co-opted by the Boogaloo movement. Has anyone heard of the Boogaloo movement? A white supremacist who advocate war against the federal government. Initially made from leftover cloth intended for kimonos, the shirts were popularized by American veterans of the Second World War. Soon, Japanese motifs were replaced by Hawaiian ones and a cultural touchstone was born. And I do think fashion houses, they say, and individual designers and sellers should speak out about people like the Boogaloo Boys using fashion for politics that encourage violence or racism. Isn't it extraordinary how fashion and clothes can signify something so awful? Black shirts, blue shirts, brown shirts, you know, once upon a time were often associated with varying level of historical discomfort. But the Hawaiian shirt, well, we can add that to the list now, by all accounts. It is amazing.
Yeah, I wonder which variety of shirt would win a fashion show. A fascist show, if you will. Sorry. Anywho, that's the best of what I'm still calling the newsings from this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. Minister for Higher Education Simon Harris joined Claire Byrne in studio this morning to talk about a pilot scheme for rapid COVID testing students who are returning to college.
You're launching this pilot scheme in May, which will provide rapid COVID testing for students. So which colleges have you chosen?
So can I just say, I'm really excited about this. I think this is a potential game changer, not just for maybe opening our colleges again, but perhaps even for actually opening a bit of society again. I'm the Minister for Health who had to cancel the Ireland-Italy rugby match. You know, we could actually start seeing outdoor gatherings, people in stadia, if rapid testing could play a really helpful role in that. Mm-hmm. So we are the Department of Science and Research, along with higher education. It makes sense for us to partner up and pilot things. So Trinity, UCC, UCD and NUI Galway have come together with some public health experts, and we're going to look at supporting this through Science Foundation Ireland. And what we will basically be doing is rolling out new innovative COVID rapid tests in both student accommodation and also in on-campus attendance. It's about 7,000 people in campuses every day. There'll be a variety of tests, saliva tests, nasal spray tests, tests you can do yourself, tests you can't do yourself. Some people will be serially tested twice a week. Some will be randomly tested. And what this is about doing is, I suppose, learning more about the tests, which could benefit the whole country. But also, I want to get our students back to college desperately. We need them back. And I think this could be another tool
in our arsenal
for September.
That they're not, they're just not reliable enough. Isn't that the problem? That they're useful when people are symptomatic.
So I'm the Minister for Research, right? So I think it makes sense for me to research them and try them. They're not the PCR test. So if you or I have symptoms, you go to your room, you ring your GP, you get your test, you isolate. But they're also, and the challenge with this virus has always been, there can be people who are asymptomatic. You can have the COVID virus within you, not feel sick. And they do seem to have benefit in picking that up. But let's see. I mean, what's the harm in seeing? Mm-hmm. We need to constantly try and get ahead of this virus. And any day we're not trying new things is a wasted day. So okay. I think this is an important step.
I just have a message that's come in to me here. Can you ask Mr. Harris about the assurance of third level students returning to college in September? I've three third level students in two different universities having paid over €9,000 in fees. Not one of them has set foot in their university this year. These young adults, I think, have had a rough time and deserve to be back at their colleges next September.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. But what I have to do is this. So let me say very clearly here on your programme today, it's my intention to dramatically increase the on-site attendance of students from the new academic year. And sometimes when I say the new year, people think I mean January. I don't. I mean the new academic year, which starts around September, October. We already have worked on a plan. We got very unlucky last year because the virus got very bad at the same time colleges were due to reopen. We've already invested a lot of money in making our colleges safer. We're now trying the rapid testing as well. We will be in a very different place with vaccination by September. So I could make a guesstimate today. I don't think it's the right time, though, because I want to get as much information and see the benefit of the vaccine programme. So in June, we'll provide a concrete update on what the new college year will look like. But to be clear, it won't look like this one. I mean, college is not about sitting in the box room or at the corner of the kitchen table. Our young people have suffered, not even educationally, actually, but from a mental health and well-being point of view. And it's not sustainable and we need to get them back. And that's what everybody is working tirelessly to do, okay. But to do it in a safe way.
I want to ask you about this story. I was talking to Alan Kelly about it, where he says that the Taoiseach needs to have a word with Minister Donnelly, the Minister for Health, about his priorities. Now, this is about Stephen Donnelly appears to be perturbed by the fact that he's not mentioned in his departmental tweets. And you, on the other hand, appeared in 10 tweets received from Graphs in the Irish Times today over the time period which was examined, which was way more than any person or entity in the Department of Higher Education. Why does it matter how many times a minister's name is mentioned in a tweet?
It doesn't. It doesn't matter at all. I mean, you.
This now coming from you. You love social media. You're on TikTok and Facebook.
I do, and you always ask me about this. I think you're more intrigued in my social media than I am. But look, I enjoy communicating on every platform that I possibly can. That's the person I am. It's the type of politician I am. Perhaps it's the generation that I'm of, and I make no apology for that. But look, I think you know me well enough from coming on this program that I offer comment on many things. I really have. No useful comment to make in relation to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that Taoiseach should have a word with him about his priorities if that's what he was concerned about on a day when there were 4,000 COVID cases confirmed?
Look, in fairness to Minister Donnelly, I know he's working flat out on the pandemic. I know a lot of the people in the Department of Health personally. I know them well. I know they're all working flat out. So,
Dermot Ferriter wrote about this recently. I'm sure you read it. He said
there's
a desperate neediness to politicians communicating their every thought, and it ends up coming across as vacuous and indulgent. And he made particular comment about you.
He
said that the Minister for Higher Education, of all things, wasting time on these analogies is a sobering reminder of the dumbing down of his profession.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't necessarily expect a historian to understand this matter, but the world is evolving and evolving rapidly. And we can't be snobby when it comes to politics.
Being a historian doesn't mean you're a relic.
No, and being a politician doesn't mean you're vacuous, right? So, which is just the charge that you've levelled at me in his words. So, why would we adopt this snobby elitist attitude, with no disrespect to your programme, which I enjoy coming on, but that the only people who are entitled to hear to their ministers are people who listen to RT Radio 1? I mean, why would we adopt that approach? And if we do adopt that approach, we're really missing a beat here. There are a lot of people of my generation and a lot of people younger, and remember, in the department that I'm in, I have a particular responsibility to them, who do go to TikTok to find their news, who do go to Instagram to find information. And I think it's important, and I actually think everybody can learn from it, including media organisations, and some are.
I think he's concerned that you're just spending too much time doing this when you should be doing other things.
That's kind of a baseless concern. I mean, I'd love to see the evidence in relation to that. I mean, I think and I hope I'm known even by my political opponents to be a hard-working minister. I've come in today to talk about a number of initiatives I want to get done. But communications isn't some kind of discretionary, silly little thing over there. It's a key part of public discourse and public debate. It's how you bring about social change in our country. Mm-hmm. You talk to people. You live in a participative democracy. You debate issues. I get a lot of criticism, a lot of abuse on social media. You know, but it is a space that is there. We can't just all stick our head in the sand and pretend it isn't.
Yeah, well, I suppose what you're saying then convinces me that you would see that it's important that a minister is mentioned in departmental tweets then.
No, I see social...
Going back around to the start.
Nicely done, but no, I mean, I see social media as important. I see it as a platform that politics, media and everyone involved in public discourse need to recognise. I don't think that it matters diddly squat how many times one individual person is or is not mentioned in an individual tweet or not. I think they're entirely different matters.
Some feisty jousting between Minister for Higher Education Simon Harris and Claire Byrne this morning. We're lied to, Ray Darcy informs us, between 10 and 200 times a day. Strangers lie 3 times within the first 10 minutes of meeting each other, and extroverts lie more than introverts. That last one explains a bit, doesn't it? All of these facts come from a book called Lie Spotting, and its author, Pamela Meyer, spoke to Ray from New York this afternoon. And the starting premise of the discussion of the lie and the lying is that not all lies are bad.
The word is really a trigger word in our culture. But in fact, it's a word that describes how we navigate complexity often. Not all lies are bad, really.
Right. So why do we lie, Pamela?
Well, you know, we all do lie, and we lie for very, very different reasons. And when I think about lying, I like to think about, like, the offensive lies and the defensive lies. So sometimes we lie just to obtain a reward that we couldn't get, or to gain an advantage over somebody, or to create a positive impression or win admiration. Other times, we lie to really control information. But many times, what we do is we're really lying to protect privacy or to get out of an awkward situation or to protect somebody else from being punished or to avoid embarrassment. So there are lots of parts of conversation and sort of who we are as humans that involve deception in some way, and it really is part of human nature.
And what's the evolutionary value of lying? Why has it survived?
Well, cavemen... You know, they had to lie to get what they needed, right? And so it starts very, very early. We know that even primates lie to some extent. You know, Coco the gorilla, the very, very famous gorilla that knew sign language, Coco once lied, you know, claiming that, you know, her pet kitten had ripped a sink out of the wall. I mean, they all lie. She used sign language doing it. But we know that it's just part of the human condition.
Right. I suppose your expertise is spotting lying. And you've been doing this for years and years and years. And does that make you a better liar?
Oh, yeah, I'm really good now. You got to be careful. I'm not a good liar in the presence of a good lie spotter, because what we do in my business and what I do with people as well is we train them not just to spot the lies, but how to get the truth. Because when you think about it, it's not that meaningful knowing that somebody lied unless you actually know what the truth is behind that lie. So there's a real science that's evolved over the last number of years in terms of what we call information elicitation that really helps you get to the truth and not just look at those particular indicators saying that someone's lying.
Okay, so you get the truth without using any sort of torture or anything like that. It's sort of just ways of talking and questions that you ask, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it depends if you're my husband or not.
Do you call out lies? That's something that I've watched your TED talk and I've read loads of interviews with you, and something you don't cover is calling out lies.
That's such an important question. I really don't recommend it. You know, it's not, most people when confronted with a lie, they'll just pull back. They're going to get really defensive and it doesn't do you any good. You know, it's better to just get as much information as you can, to sit on it for a while, and then think about a way to talk about it that involves giving someone a few off-ramps so they can really communicate to you about why they lied and what the external information may be around that. So, you know, you may say to somebody, look, it's not that big a deal, but I really need to get a better understanding of, like, what happened Friday night. I know you were late. I'm not accusing you of anything, but it would be helpful to understand. You know, and when you talk about it that way with somebody, they're going to be a lot more likely to tell you what was going on than, like, where were you? Yes. I know you were at the office with that colleague. It just doesn't work.
Right. Okay. Now, we have, you use this in your TED talk, and I hope you don't mind if we use this again, because it's classic lying, and it's the sort of the verbals around lying. So I'm going to play this clip of Bill Clinton when he was president of the United States of America at a press conference after the whole Monica Lewinsky controversy. So here we go.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Some people were convinced by what he said. Now, we all know now that what he said was a lie, but you would have been able to spot then that what he was saying was a lie.
Well, yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton is what we call a conditioned witness. He's ready. He's at the ready, and he's probably practiced very carefully. But still, you know, there are a bunch of indicators there. You know, when the cognitive load is high and you're trying to think what to say, act composed, appear spontaneous, you leak these verbal cues and nonverbal cues. And the verbal ones on this one, you know, he said, I did not have sexual relations. Well, we know that we call that a non-contracted denial. Did not versus didn't, could not versus couldn't. Uh-huh. Liars will unconsciously formalize their language. And, you know, this data point goes around the world. We see this in every language.
I did
he
not.
Also,
oh, there you
the
go. Just playing it again for them.
Like,
I was just playing it again from there.
Yeah, play it again.
I did not.
Ah, yes. Instead of I didn't.
Right,
I
exactly.
Did not.
Ah, yeah, very good. Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, I mean, he said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Right? I mean, he's distancing himself unconsciously with his language. And liars often do this. They unconsciously distance themselves with the language that they use. They'll use the third person. They'll say that woman. And the other thing that he did is he said Monica Lewinsky. Then he narrowed it. And the thing that we know is that when you're in a denial of having done something and you're lying, oftentimes you narrow the field of your denial. Like Bill Clinton, right? He couldn't say, hey, I never had sex outside my marriage in my life. We know he couldn't say that,
yes.
That categorical denial.
I see, yes,
so
yes.
That people want to appear truthful, so they narrow it so they right. can actually feel very truthful okay. in what they're saying.
And what about, you know, the detail around a lie? Do people tend to give more detail when they're lying or not?
Well, so oftentimes, I mean, have you ever had teenagers around you? You probably know this, or anybody that's listening does. People will overstate the detail. We call this a lie sandwich. You know, they'll kind of give you too much authentic detail around the lie so they feel like they're being authentic, when in fact what they're doing is that they're providing with an inappropriate amount of statement information, as we say.
Okay.
So oftentimes the detail's way too much.
Right. Now,
because they're trying to seem honest.
Lie spotting author Pamela Meyer talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. Let's all try to act casual and we'll definitely get away with it. Am I right? Ryan Tuberty spoke to counsellor and therapist Brian Sinnott from Tiglin, and he asked him if there was an accepted definition of what a dry drunk is.
It was a term that was created by the creators of the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step.
Mm.
And their definition is this: the presence of actions and attitudes that categorise the alcoholic prior to recovery. That's their definition. In a 1970 book called The Dry Drunk Syndrome.
Right.
Very good read. So the actions and attitudes are still there. In fact, I would go further and say they're probably magnified. They're worse.
Yeah, flesh that out for me then. So this is somebody who's thinking of giving up the booze, and you're almost like cold turkey. Is that the sort of area we're talking about?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, and it's how you look at addiction is very important. And how we need to look at addiction is that the problem isn't just stop the substance, whether it's alcohol or other illicit drugs, stop the substance and you're fine. Addiction goes as far as physically, but it goes psychologically and even spiritually as well. Mm. It permeates, it affects the whole of the human being. And that's why good, thorough treatment is very, very important, not a superficial, just stop the booze.
What we're hearing is the horrible fallout. So if an alcoholic is in a house on their own, they can just damage themselves and the four walls around that surround them. It's this awful side effects it has on humans that they live with that is so damaging. And the difficulty is, you'd want a heart of stone not to have some sympathy for the alcoholic also, because they, you know, there's a reason for it too. But if they're a horrible alcoholic, you know the way some people can be almost a benign drunk, if you like. But if you're horrible, if you're vindictive, if you're cruel, if you're physically abusive, you're now living in the tyranny we've talked about before.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you're talking about this, Ryan, because it's a subject that's very close to my heart, because there are many families in Ireland that are living a nightmare because of exactly what you're talking about. Mm. And they have someone at home that is in early recovery or in what's called late recovery. They're 20 years off the substance, but they're living in hell. And there's a phrase we often use, and I'm sure your listeners will be aware of it, a street angel and a house devil.
Sure.
And I think we probably all know people like that. Mm. I mean, it is quite pervasive in our culture. And there needs to be sympathy and support for the family. I would also argue there needs to be sympathy and support, but not enabling for the person who is off the substance. That actually, great that they're off the substance, but that's only step one. Many people in addiction have told me, hundreds in fact have told me, that getting off the substance is difficult, but that's the easy bit. Going from being sober to sober-minded is the real journey. To coming to a place of calm, coming to a place of rest within yourself, a place of wholeness. That's a completely different journey, really. Mm. So to say that someone is off the substance, well, that should be celebrated, but it's only step one. It's only putting the key into the ignition, if you understand what I mean. There's so many other things that need to happen for the journey of recovery to be possible. And or to be productive. Otherwise, everybody else around them is living a nightmare. And what can often happen is someone says, well, I'm off the substance now, or I've been to treatment, so now you owe me, and I am the moral authority in the house now because I've conquered this thing. And it can be just terrible to live with.
Even the language you're using is so menacing. You know, you owe me, I'm in charge, I give up the drink. Now this is what you wanted, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is. And what often happens, Ryan, is a fascinating but awful thing, is that you can switch from one addiction to the other. So someone gives up, let's say, alcohol, but then they still have this craving psychologically and physiologically. And we forget, Ryan, that things like anger and rage release very powerful addictive substances inside in us.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Yeah. That if an addict has an addiction to one thing, the anger can it's almost a replacement.
Yeah, it's a replacement substance, but you have to do something to make it happen. So instead of picking up the bottle, well, you have to get angry, or a rage is often a part of this dry drunk syndrome, and a sense of inferiority, but it expresses itself in a superior form. And in a superiority.
So they release it by picking a fight with an innocent party.
With anybody.
With anybody. But they generally tend to do it from what I understand, at home. And then they go outside, and now the angel leaves the front door and the devil is left behind.
Yeah, because anyone who knows anything to do with addiction will know that shame is a huge issue for the person in addiction. So if shame is the huge issue, well, you can't hide at home very easily, but you can hide to your next door neighbours. You can hide to the extended family. And often the dry drunk is the star of the party, is the funny guy in the crowd, is the celebrity in some way in a local dynamic or whatever else it is. And then when they come home,
the children and the spouse, they're living a nightmare.
So he's,
and it's a terrible conflict for the family because they see, well, everybody else thinks they're great, but, wow, we must be wrong, you know?
Why doesn't the shame travel both ways? In other words, you're suggesting the person will feel ashamed as soon as they step outside the front door, outside the house.
Yes.
Why doesn't the shame follow them back inside so that when they're horrible to somebody like a wife or a child, why can't they feel ashamed of being so horrible to those innocent people?
Well, familiarity breeds contempt. And you can't keep the front up at home.
Okay.
Everybody knows what we're like at home. We're different when we're at home and we're out. We have social masks on, whatever they may be.
Yeah.
But we are who we are at home. We can't keep an act up at home. That doesn't work. Not for too long anyway.
That's terrifying. And I tell you, it's even more terrifying because people can't leave their house now. So, nature in all its cruelty has doubled down on that unpleasantness for people. And unpleasantness being too little a word for too big a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I reckon, Ryan, this is anecdotal, I don't have the figures to back this up, but I reckon that an awful lot of our domestic abuse has to do with this dry drunk syndrome. And the two aspects of it is there's one thing to be said for the guy or the lady who gives up the substance voluntarily, say, I'm deciding to give up whatever substance it is, whiskey or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's another thing, another ballgame altogether for someone who doesn't want to give up the substance but can't afford to buy it because they're unemployed. They're a complete nightmare to live with.
What happens to them?
Well, what happens to them is they become enraged.
Yeah.
Because people often don't understand addiction, that it's not just about putting down the bottle. But another word for addiction is dependency. It's a fabulous word to understand it. Because when someone's in true addiction, they would prefer the substance than drawing oxygen. It's about survival. The body speaks to the mind and says, you are not going to survive unless you take whatever substance it is. And it's very, very real. That's the inside mind of someone who's in addiction. So to say, just put down the bottle, that actually isn't the full answer at all. And I think it's the answer that many people give, that the drink is the problem. You mentioned that earlier on. The drink isn't the problem. The drink is the symptom. And it's the symptom of a whole load of emotional baggage.
Yes.
And the taking of the substance is medication. I mean, alcohol is old-fashioned medication. Illicit drugs that you get on the streets, it's medication.
Because, is it the sense that people with issues like this are on the run, and that's from demons?
Yeah. It's an escape. It's always an escape because the pain is too much to face with. And that's why treatment is really important, and good treatment, because there's a lot of group work. There's a lot of acceptance and love and work on identity and all that kind of stuff, which is very, very important. Very thorough, but very possible. If there's anyone stuck in addiction today, it's very, very possible to get out of that, but you can't do it yourself. Not possible to do it yourself.
That's a huge thing to say. You can't do it yourself. And I've seen what you guys do in Tiglin up close in my brief encounters with clients and people who work the system there. I work up in the system there with Aubrey and friends. And what struck me about it is that everyone who's had an addiction generally has a story, has a soul, and has a heart.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, watching it at that level, and my dad was a psychiatrist who dealt with a lot of people with addiction problems too, so maybe a bit of it rubbed off me in terms of curiosity on the subject, if nothing else, is that heart and that soul and that story is often reduced so much so that the person's lost sight of reality.
Yeah, that reality is too tough.
Yes.
Reality is too hard. And there's always a few common stories of trauma or rejection or pain or an emptiness. Simple and emptiness, and there can be a myriad of sources, but they all come down to the fact that the human mind or heart, whichever you want to call it, is aching, and unless that's and if you take away the substance that's medicating that ache, well, that ache comes out at home.
That's counsellor and therapist Brian Sinnott from Tiglin talking to Ryan Tuberty this morning about dry drunks and people with dependencies. If you've been affected by any of the topics discussed in this excerpt, you can get further information from the Al-Anon Confidential Helpline on 01 873 2699 or the Tiglin House website, tiglin.ie. The death of Shay Healey was announced over the weekend. The songwriter and entertainer died after a long battle with Parkinson's disease. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Professor Tim Lynch, consultant neurologist and clinical director at the Dublin Neurological Institute, spoke about the disease, and Claire started by asking him about the overall picture of Parkinson's in this country.
How many people in Ireland do we know currently have Parkinson's disease?
Morning, Claire. That's not clear, unfortunately. Often statistics in Ireland medicine are a bit hampered because we don't actually have proper sort of databases and a unified identified number for each person in the country. So it's hard to be exactly accurate. Some people would attend different clinics and different hospitals and different GPs. But we estimate somewhere between 10 to 12,000 have Parkinson of some type. But that's a guesstimation.
Is the incidence on the increase?
Yeah, very much so. Unfortunately, Parkinson's disease is the most rapidly increasing neurodegenerative disorder in the world actually at present. So it's getting... As we age, is a risk factor for developing Parkinson's, like developing Alzheimer's. But for some reason, Parkinson's is accelerating quicker than Alzheimer's.
What causes it?
Big debate. We've done a fair bit of research out of the matter for a number of years, as have others, looking at different familial aspects to it. So sometimes you'll see it in a family member, and you might find that it's more common in that family, although usually it doesn't go down through the generations one after the other. There are exceptions to that, and there are some families with specific genes that we know that have increased the risk of getting Parkinson's, and we've done some studies in those families. So there are less common causes are genetic. More commonly or more most likely that there's some environmental factor that seems to land on a fertile soil. By that I mean if somebody has a genetic predisposition they've inherited and there's an environmental trigger of some type lands on that predisposition, they get Parkinson's. And there's a raging debate about that at present. So, for example, going back prior to the Industrial Revolution, back in the late 18th century into the early 18th century, I should say, Parkinson's seemed to be less common. I mean, the first clinical description of it was in 1817 by James Parkinson's. But before that, wasn't as well identified in literature. So there's a suspicion, certainly, and evidence that it's increasing in frequency over the last 200 years.
And the symptoms are wide-ranging, aren't they? Causes a lot of problems.
Yes, very much so. Often when somebody comes in to see us, and we have explained that somebody may have motor symptoms, if I use that term, they may have tremor, they may be slow, they may be stooped, they may have a poor balance problem, they may have difficulty walking. And then they sometimes what I call non-motor symptoms, which are very important, and we were perhaps slow to identify those up to about 10 years ago. And they include various things like actually constipation, bladder troubles, anxiety, poor sleep, memory troubles, sometimes hallucinations if the Parkinson's progresses over a period of time. So there's quite a big spectrum of non-motor symptoms that can be as much of a nuisance, if not more so, than the motor problems.
And how controllable are they? How manageable are those symptoms?
We're pretty good at that symptomatic control. We have an array of different medications, firstly, to manage it. But even before we get to that, often we're advising patients about make sure they keep themselves healthy and well by various things like exercise, intellectual activity, good sleep, good diet, and a good keen sense of humour, if they can maintain one. But then in addition to that, we complement that with a whole series of medications. The best medications is a thing called levodopa, which was invented actually in the movie Awakenings, captures that with Oliver Sacks being played by our friend who developed Lewy body disease, and I'm blanking on his name at
present. Don't worry, that's
fine. It'll come to me. In that, they describe the discovery of levodopa that replaces the chemical lacking in the brain called dopamine, and it's highly effective. And then from there, you can go on even to further therapies, including what are called continuous therapies and deep brain stimulation surgery. And we have the All-Ireland Deep Brain Stimulation Centre in the matter, and recently have appointed the first female neurosurgeon, Catherine Moran, to the matter, and Beaumont, who will be starting to do those surgeries in Beaumont, hopefully, God willing, this year.
You can survive and live a long time with Parkinson's, but it is progressive, isn't it?
It is, yeah, and it varies, though, and every person comes in, they're different, and I always explain that to them. Robin Williams, his name just popped into my brain. There you go, my brain misbehaved itself, but then I retrieved it. It's amazing how that happens.
Well, at least you know why that happens.
Yeah. I think I'm getting old. Yeah, so we were on, was it DBS you asked me?
I was saying to you that it's a progressive disease.
Yeah.
You can survive for a long time, but you can find it that it's increasingly difficult.
So, I always try and be a positive patient. And I have somebody in my clinic who walks in with Parkinson's after 55 years. His onset came in his early 20s, and he's now in his 70s with Parkinson's. So some people are still trotting along many, many years later on, whereas others get into trouble pretty quickly. It's not clear why that is so, but there's quite a bit of variety in it, and it is thought to be something to do with the genetic background of those patients, but some people get into trouble pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, Shea was in action with his Parkinson's for quite a while, and he was a remarkable man, actually, Gordon. He maintained an amazing, keen sense of humour, really, that, throughout the whole thing, which was very positive from that perspective.
Yeah, I saw him a couple of years ago walking through near here on a street near here, and he was quite debilitated, you know, with the shakes and so on. But he was in great form and still moving and still able to keep active. And that's what you're saying is really important, the physical activity and, yeah, the mental activity.
I think that's absolutely true. And certainly if the first one or two visits somebody comes in, you give a diagnosis of Parkinson's. That's a tough diagnosis. And it's really important, if they can, to get through the process of that, which is, of course, rejection and anger and why me, and then sadness and then acceptance, and trying to get through that reprocess and then get into a more proactive state. There's clear evidence in science and neuroscience that clinical exercise is important for brain function. We've got 100 billion neurons in our brain, but each neuron has got a connection to many, many others, you trillion of synapses. So there's a structural change in your brain when you're doing exercise, in that you make more synapses and makes us more efficient at walking and gives more robustness to the brain. The same applies to intellectual activity and particularly novelty. If you give the brain a novel challenge, the patient in the 70s, late 70s, is now teaching himself Japanese with Parkinson's, which is a heck of a challenge.
With Parkinson's?
Yeah. And that's a heck of a challenge. I mean, I find if I try and learn something at the moment, my brain screams at me for the first 3 to 6 months, but then it picks up. And that probably is because I'm generating new connections and synapses that gives more, again, more health to the brain. Mm-hmm. So clearly both exercise and keeping the person busy and active, and if possible taking on a new challenge, is really helpful. And that's hard because often it's coming in with a stage when we're at retirement in later in life and we want to slow down a bit and be less active. But I suppose as I'm getting older, I'm thinking the same lines, pot calling and kettle black, I should be active.
Can we talk about that? Because I know that's one of the things you really want to people to be aware of, that what we do right now is going to be the predictor of what happens down the line. So keeping active, learning new things, and making sure that once we get to retirement, we have a plan.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's women are better at this than men, unfortunately. Us men come up to retirement and bang, we're suddenly retired. Women have maintained a lot of activities and social contacts above and beyond work. And that's key because social contacts are very important for brain health. And there's clear evidence that people with good social contacts are less at risk of developing neurodegenerative disease, in particular Alzheimer's. People who exercise decrease the risk of getting Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. People who have intellectual activity and maintain cognition have decreased risk of it. Sleep is another key important aspect to it. It wasn't known up to about a decade ago, but when we fall asleep at night, our brain swells. And the reason it does that is it opens up new channels, what we call glymphatics, which are side by side to the big vessels in the brain, and they wash and clear the brain of various things that accumulate during the day, in particular abnormal proteins, which we call amyloid and tau, that are associated with Alzheimer's, get cleared out, and a protein called alpha-synuclein that's associated with Parkinson's get washed out. So we know, for example, if you're in a shift worker, you're at higher risk of developing Alzheimer's. Margaret Thatcher, great woman, but 3 hours sleep at night, and unfortunately Alzheimer's got her. So there's a message in that, that we should look after ourselves from an exercise, intellectual activity, good sleep, and then diet gets in, and in particular vitamin D, probably over the winter months in Ireland, is very key. It's important for bone health but also for brain health.
Professor Tim Lynch, consultant neurologist, talking to Claire Byrne about Parkinson's disease this morning. On Monday's Liveline, Ray Morrissey told Joe Duffy how he was hit by a car while cycling last weekend. The car didn't stop. On this afternoon's programme, Margaret Burke talked about her sister Breda, who was also hit by a car that didn't stop.
Okay, what happened?
Yes, she decided to go for a walk last Tuesday, and she stopped there at the busy junction at Fagan's Pub to cross the road.
Okay.
Now, the traffic light there gave her the go-ahead to proceed, so she went about crossing over, and before she knew it, there was a bicycle wheel between her two legs, and she had been knocked to the ground.
Oh, God.
So, Joe, to make a very long story short, Breda was knocked down. She didn't realise at the time how bad her injury was. The cyclist did stop, yes, and she said that her bell wasn't working. Now, Breda, of course, was very angry at the time and traumatised on the ground. Mm-hmm. And a passerby helped her up, a very kind gentleman, and proceeded to see how she was, and they realised that she had a good injury, and proceeded to go to the Mater hospital with her.
And just to be clear, Margaret,
yes,
your sister Breida, she was crossing the road at the correct time. She had the right of way.
Yes.
And you're saying
exactly,
the cyclist.
The lights were green.
Okay. So the cyclist who hit her came through red lights.
Apparently, yes. Breida had all clear to go.
Okay, well, then they came through red lights.
She was on the ground.
Okay, and she said to Breida, the cyclist said, as Breida lay on the ground, my bell isn't working.
Her bell wasn't working. Well, she did apologise. Well, it's not. Hang on,
but it's not her bell that wasn't working. It's her it's her eyesight that wasn't working.
To be honest, Joe, that is what my sister said at the time to her, you know, in anger and complete frustration that, you know, it's your eyes that really that you should be able to look at the light. But anyway, I know accidents do happen. The reason why I felt so strong about getting on to you, Joe, is that to make a long story short, Breida has a fractured humerus, and which is a serious injury.
Yeah.
And she's black and blue all over, swollen. She cannot do very much for herself in the last week. She lives alone.
Oh, God.
She has wonderful neighbours and friends and family, of course, that were trying to assist. Her family is living in the country, so and she's in Dublin. And she's waiting to go back to the hospital tomorrow, hoping that the swelling will be gone down enough for them to be able to do more for her. She cannot wash, clean, cook, drive, nothing at the moment because of this. And we feel that there's so much talk at the moment and ads about motorists hitting cyclists.
Yeah, which is awful.
Well,
yeah.
This is the opposite way around of a cyclist, an accident hitting the pedestrian. Is there any, there's no insurance? Is there any comeback for Breida? Like, if this is going to have an impact on her life going forward, I'd say for many months to come.
Yeah.
Where does one go? Now, the kind gentleman that did assist her and take her to the hospital did stop a Gardaí on their way and told him of the accident. The Gardaí did take note of her name and address and said accidents like this happen all the time. And he said he would contact her back, or she was to contact him, the following day. Now, Breida has tried to contact him in the middle of all the trauma, but she found out, I think recently, that he's not on duty until tomorrow.
Okay.
So, like, it's so traumatising, and it has just highlighted to us all as to how the pedestrian can be affected. And the cyclist, is there rules on the road for cyclists?
And did she give...
insurance?
Did the cyclist give her name to... To either Breida or the...
No. We don't know who this lady is. She cycled away into the sunset and...
But she would have been aware. The cyclist would have been aware because your sister was on the ground, you tell me.
Yes.
Yeah. I presume there was a kerfuffle of people trying to help her, including that man.
I'm sure there was, yes.
Who took her to hospital.
And yes, what well, the kind gentleman did. Now, I wasn't there, and Breida was too traumatised to come on the show today to speak to you, so I really felt I had to speak on her behalf, you know.
And did you get the name of the man who took her to hospital?
He didn't want to give his name, you know. He was just a
nice
kind gentleman
yeah.
who helped her so much and spoke to the Gardaí, and they have details of that all
And
right.
she had a broken humerus, which is, it's your arm, obviously, and it's extraordinarily debilitating.
Absolutely.
In terms of living on your own, in terms of everything in your life.
In terms of everything. Now, with COVID and everything, you're told to you know, go for a walk, get out there, breathe. You know, she worked in a pub and lost work there a year ago because of COVID.
Oh, God.
And it doesn't look like now, even if things are opening up, what her future holds. Because she's going to have many months of rehabilitation because of this injury. And, you know, it's just that we're lost on it. It's just a highlight to listeners that could have been a mother and a baby and a pram. You know, what I'm trying to say is motorists, you have a comeback with a motorist. You have help, you have assistance there, you have the law. What is out there with regards to cyclists? There is no law, is there, out there? I don't know. Is there any comeback for Breda with compensation to help her in the next few months?
Mm-hmm.
Can anyone out there help or tell us?
Margaret Burke talking about her sister Breda's ordeal on this afternoon's Liveline. The thought of going on a city break in a foreign land seems at this stage like something from a science fiction novel. But the team on Today with Claire Byrne dare to dream, and so they roped in travel writer Rosalind Dee and sports commentator George Hamilton to talk about their favourite and their not-so-favourite cities in Europe. Claire asked George where he'd go if he could get on a plane in the morning. His answer? Munich.
Munich, it strikes me, is the perfect compromise between German efficiency and Italian joie de vivre. They often refer to Munich as the most northerly Italian city, and it is a bit like that. It's just a wonderful place to go. I first visited in 1971 when they were digging the place up to get ready for the Olympic Games of 72. I've been back many times since to what has now become the most magnificent pedestrian area, which you start at the western end at Karlsplatz, which the locals don't call Karlsplatz because it was named after a very unpopular elector. Instead, they call it Stachus, which was the name of a local pub, and it was knocked down for the creation of the Karlsplatz. So you go into Munich and you ask for Karlsplatz, they look at you and they say, no, no, you mean Stachus. Walk from there down the pedestrian street past the largest Renaissance church north of the Alps, where I saw Juventus football fans go in for some devotions on the afternoon of a game. And you'll eventually arrive through the Kaufingerstrasse in Marienplatz, past the onion domes of the Frauenkirche, and look up at the Glockenspiel on the Neues Rathaus as the Bavarian knight takes on an invader and wins every time, on the hour, every hour.
Oh, gosh, I'm there, George. Rosalind, your first choice, then?
Would be Genoa. Or Genova, as the Italians call it. Now, no direct flights from here to there is the one downside, but you can fly into Milan. It's only an hour and a half by train from Milan. Milano Centrale train station in itself is just astonishing to see. But Genoa is, you know, Genoa is one of those cities. It's the largest port in Italy. So it's not, you know, it's not picture postcard beautiful. But I quite like that. It has that set. It's a bit rough around the edges, Claire.
Yeah, that's what
I'm
saying. Give us a sense of the location, why you feel it's so special.
Well, I love it. It's on the coast, of course. So it's there. You're on the Ligurian coastline. Not particularly touristy part. Christopher Columbus came from there. So obviously the whole port aspect dominates the city. But it also has these amazing, they call them the Roly Palaces. Now, Roly largely just means list. It's a list. So it's a city that boasts these extraordinary 16th and century, 17th century palaces. I mean, nowadays there's 163 of them dotted across two or three streets. They are largely now, some are still private residences. Most of them are galleries or museums and some are offices. But within that 163, Claire, there are 42 of them which have been designated as the Roly Palaces. And they, as a kind of collective, are a World Heritage Site. And they're just beautiful. I mean, there's the Palazzo Bianco with its amazing art collection, the Palazzo Rossi where there's a Caravaggio. And the trick with the Palazzo Rossi, Rosso, because I saw Genoa. I spent a morning with the most amazing young man who was my guide. I've never recommended somebody, you know, in print or on the air before, but if anybody goes to Genoa, it's worth a few bob to get hold of Andrea Azzinari for a few hours to walk you around the city.
We're all writing that name down.
So he told me when you go to Palazzo Rosso, he said, we need to rush. I said, why do we need to rush? He said, because it's starting to rain, and when the rain comes down, it's slippy on the roof and they close it off to tourists. So let's get there fast. And the views from the roof of the Palazzo Rosso are astonishing.
The insider knowledge. You're both big fans of Madrid, and Rosalind, that was the last trip you went on. It was a day trip.
Yeah, it was January 2020. Remember that, Claire? Remember way back then? My son, my adult son, I took him as a surprise a week after his birthday. So we went for the day. So we went out on a crack of dawn flight and we were home again by midnight. And we had a ball. I know Madrid quite well. I visited it many times with my late husband. I much prefer it to Barcelona. Much prefer it to Barcelona. But yeah, we
did. And did a day trip give you enough time to do what
great.
You needed to do?
I have it quite well sort of scheduled. So we were there. I think we were actually sitting down in the famous chocolateria in Madrid called San Ginés, where they all go for their breakfast after their nights out, and they have chocolate, thick chocolate drink, and the churros, they dip the churros in. I mean, it's heart attack time, you know. But so we were there in time for that, and we did the open top bus tour, which I always recommend, actually pretty much in most cities. If you go somewhere for the first time, it gives you a great kind of perspective, you know. Mm-hmm. And what I would often do is do it once, stay on board the whole way, and then go again and get off and on to see the sights. So we did that. The Retiro Park in Madrid is really beautiful. Massive park, right smack bang in the heart of the city. Big boating lake, lovely place to walk. And if you're there, if you're in Madrid, we went there on a Sunday, so we didn't see the Rastro, which is the famous flea market in Madrid every Sunday. It's enormous. It takes over streets and streets and streets. But we did all the sights. We had tapas in my favourite tapas place, which is Casa del Abuelo, real spit and sawdust, very near Puerto del Sol, so again, very central. You have to like prawns, that's all they do, but they do it in various forms. You have to like either red or white wine, but that's it. There's no choice within the red or white. And we did the, George will know more about this than me, but we did the tour of the Bernabeu, the Real Madrid Stadium. I mean, I am into football. My son loved it. We didn't do an actual, you know, escorted tour. We paid in and we did our own thing. So we spent a long time there. It's really brilliant. And my son, who for his sins is a Man United fan, felt that actually the dressing rooms, all those areas, were actually superior to Old Trafford. But there's a few wee hidden gems as well there. I mean, you don't often think of going to visit a station when you go to a city, but the Estación de Atocha, it's amazing. It has this giant tropical garden inside. Mm-hmm. So you walk in and you feel the heat. There's the huge plants. There's colonies of turtles. It's just extraordinary, and all within walking distance. And of course, there's the art. I mean, there's the Prado. There's all of that.
The good places are all well and good, but what about the bad places? Claire asked Rosalind and George about the city they wouldn't be rushing back to.
I don't like Barcelona.
Barcelona?
No.
Okay.
I know half the world flocks to Barcelona.
But it's not for you.
I only went once, didn't like it. Thought it tried too hard. I know it sounds silly maybe to say, kind of tries too hard to be cool. You know, like, get over yourself.
And George, what about you?
Manchester.
You'll be in right trouble for that.
I come from Belfast, and Belfast grew up in the Victorian era around heavy industry, and I'm not really a big fan of that. I like Belfast, of course, because I come from there, but I'm not really a big fan of that kind of city. And as a former colleague, Brian Walker, once said to me when he moved from Belfast to Manchester, and I bumped into him on the street in Manchester one afternoon, I said to him in the course of our conversation, "Have you settled here?" And he said, "Not at all." He said, "You can only give your allegiance to one small provincial town."
Ouch. George Hamilton confirming he's not a Manchester City or United fan. And Rosalind D, not being enamoured of Barcelona, on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE Radio Player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.